Intercultural Gospel and Worship of the Early Church. That's sort of a poor title. So if I could title it over again, I would say it's just the end-cultured gospel. Okay, because we're not going to only talk about how it was different, but we're all also going to talk about how the worship practices of the early church were similar and kind of recognizable to the Romans that were around them. So first, let's talk about Christian spirituality within first century Roman culture in the eyes of Romans. And here are three terms that we can find in Roman authors that described Christian spirituality. In the church, in the New Testament, for example, we have the word Greek word ecclesia. That's where we get ecclesiology and some churches named ecclesia. And so we have that. But then outside of the Christian literature, we also have Roman, non-Christian literature talking about Christian spirituality. And here are three terms that are used for churches or for church Christian faith and church spirituality. So first one that we'll look at, the first one is religion. And the Greek word is eusebia. I'll write these down. That's an E. Eusebia, and that can be translated religion, maybe piety. Actually, this word is found in the New Testament a handful of times, like in Acts as well as in the pastoral epistles. I think it's 2 Peter. And so we have this word eusebia, or religion, or piety. And so for the average inhabitants of Roman cities, religion meant something, or eusebia meant something public, something to do with sacrifices, processions, festivals, something that is not a private affair. What we call today religious practices, for them, are more centered on not beliefs, but actual rituals. So we're talking about rituals that Romans did. The Romans actually considered themselves very religious. In fact, their really religiosity, their eusebia, set them apart from other peoples in their self-estimation. And they were religiously quite conservative. They were very suspicious of new religions. Okay, so think of like a civic kind of religion, a state religion. These are public things that we all do, rituals, rites, festivals, processions. And in their self-estimation, we are good. As a Roman Empire, we are good because we are much more religious than other people groups. Okay? Piety was about showing respect for the gods, any and all gods. And we should note that in the ancient world, again, religion is part of the fabric of social and political life. So it wasn't like a private thing, it was a public thing. And they didn't think so much in terms of like believing in God, as in having a god. The Roman world was full of gods, and religion was about being a good citizen, doing your part to ensure the welfare, the well-being of the city from divine benefactors like God. So like in Ephesus, Artemis, or in another city, Zeus, to promote kinship and mutual responsibility. See, religion was to them what, for us, the local sports team might be, the local festival might be, local politics. See, if you move to in this new city, you just pick up worship of the gods of that city, just like we might pick up the local sports team and vote in our own local elections or go to our town street fairs. That's what eusebia was in the Roman world. You know, what does it mean to be a good Jackson villager?
Jacksonvillian,
what does it mean to be a good Houstonian, New Yorker, whatever? And, you know, I think that would help us think about what it means to be a good Roman, and Eusebia is a big part of that. So what does it mean to, like, so if someone was a resident of Jacksonville and hated the Jaguars, how would your town feel about that?
We understand.
Yeah.
Okay, but
it is a major problem.
Okay, yeah. Sorry?
Not this year.
Okay, not this year. This year. Let's say on Sunday, what if, you know, people were like burning Jacksonville flag or Jaguars flag on their jerseys in effigy. You know, that's not being a good Jacksonvillian. And so in the same way, Romans in their cities worshiping the local deities, the gods that had a particular eye for that city, was part of civic life, was part of civic duty. That's what you do. You know, if you, it would be like if someone moved to your neighborhood and they never came outside, they didn't do trick-or-treating, like their lights were all out to keep their kids inside, no candy anywhere. There's like a local festival going on. Oh, it's, you know, Jacksonville Days, you know, and it's October 21st to 23rd on, you know, Maple Avenue. And everyone come out, there's gonna, all our local shops will be represented there, et cetera. And I'm like, oh, please, no, you know, I don't want, well, you know, Girl Scouts come to your door. It's like, oh, you know, no, I don't want any part of that. You would say, that person's just not a good neighbor, not a good citizen. And that's how Romans viewed religion. If you don't take part in our civic rights, then you're not a good Roman. Okay, that's religion for them. It's wrapped up in a public social life, okay? They didn't think of conversion as metaphysical and private. They thought of religion as public and civic. So you don't like convert to worshiping Artemis. You just move to Ephesus, and that's what you do. So it's actually likely that early Christian evangelism wasn't so much helping non-Christians have a private experience of God or a private change of beliefs, but it was giving people a new set of worship practices with a different divine person, the Spirit of Jesus, suffusing these practices and participation in a new community. Okay, we'll unpack that a little bit more. The other word, the second word that we have in our Roman sources for Christian spirituality is superstition, and the Latin word is superstitio. Okay, sort of like mission is missio, superstition is superstitio. And that's a word that Romans used to describe foreign cults. It's not that they were completely different entities. The difference between legitimate worship of the divine and superstitio, like religion versus superstitio, was like the difference between syncretism and orthodox faith, whether it was good and helpful or bad and destructive. Superstitious basically meant foreign. So it's not like superstitious, like, oh, you know, throw salt behind you and you have these weird rituals. Superstitious just meant foreign, okay? They use the same word to talk about Egyptian religion or Jewish religion, okay? So we have religion, superstition, and then finally association. That's another image of the church. And association can be sort of like a community group, like a club, a social club. And it can revolve around your occupation. It can revolve around interests. It can, it's basically like, what do we call it at lunch? Affinity groups. Affinity groups. Okay? An association is an affinity group. And so you'd have groups of all kinds, and they collect dues. Like, you become a member. There are certain rites that are involved, typically involving like the Roman gods. You know, this is what we do when we get together. We use your membership dues to pay for things when you need help. Like, a big example would be a funeral, actually. So these societies took care of members' funeral expenses. Like, if one person dies, then we'll take care of your funeral expenses because you paid your dues. There's officers and so on. And these associations, when they got together, they always got together for meals. That was how social life worked. They got together for meals. And that's just what associations do in the Roman world. They eat together. So it's a little bit different from a lot of our associations, where the meal is, I don't know, sometimes there, sometimes not. I think usually not, I don't know, right?
Usually it's at a time where you, yeah.
Outside of mealtime.
Yeah.
Right. So in the Roman world, associations always meant for meals. An association. So let's then think about the church in relation to this. So some shared traits that Christian spirituality in the early Roman Empire. So again, I'm not talking about Christian spirituality in a culturalist way, like an abstract Christian spirituality, but I'm talking about first century Roman Empire Christian spirituality. And how did that spirituality look within the context of a broader first century Roman culture? All right, so some shared traits. Yes, we're an association. And so we can actually, we won't turn to them, but 1 Corinthians 11, that's a passage in which Paul talks about the bread and wine. And the assumption there is that it's a meal, because his concern is some people like just pick up
overindulge,
you know, and other people come in and there's no food for them. And Paul says that's shameful. Okay, and like how is that proclaiming the death of Christ? And here we see that the assumption is that they're gathered for a meal. Okay, and I know sometimes we think today, actually you're against church, the house church, right? When you do, the communion is a meal as well. Mm-hmm. So you guys are very Roman in that way. And, yeah, exactly. So yeah, we might actually ask that question. Well, in church history, what happened to that? 1 Corinthians 11 seems to be about a meal communion. Communion meal, as opposed to just like a wafer and a truly tiny cup. I was like, oh, what happened? Like, why do we do this versus that? And I think a big answer to that is just particularization. You know, because in that time period, they had the meal. Because every time any group got together, there was a meal. And so in our context, our groups generally don't have meals together. We don't schedule a church at 6 o'clock on a weeknight or on a Sunday. We don't schedule church at 12. But we have these practices that develop because of our particular context. And so we see that the church needs to eat and drink, and we see this also in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, in Ephesians 5:18. Does anyone remember that offhand? It's just one verse.
Be not drunk with wine.
Yes, do not get drunk with wine, but
be filled with the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, right? As you sing psalms and spiritual songs to each other.
Controlled by the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, all right. So there, let's think in terms of context, and not so much, oh, what's the difference between, you know, is Paul drawing a comparison between this experience of the Holy Spirit versus the experience of getting drunk, so that the Spirit feels like getting drunk? I guess it's possible to make the argument, many people have. But I think when we think about context, we think, okay, all these associations in the Roman Empire, they would get together and eat and drink, and a lot of times get drunk. And here's a Christian association that gets together to eat and drink. And what's distinctive about Christian spirituality, the Christian association? Well, we don't get drunk. We get filled with the Holy Spirit. Okay? So that's Ephesians 5:18 in a Roman context. Just like other associations, this first century Roman Empire church talked about and promoted their goals and values. And so that's where actually the rest of that Ephesians 5:18, 19-20 get into play. You know, sing songs in your heart with gratitude, sing songs with gratitude in your hearts to Christ. With shared resources, when we talk about like membership dues, privileges, like burial things, that's what the church did. You know, it looks a lot like an association, like a Roman association. There's initiation rites, just like a Roman association would have. And in what way was the early church's, Roman Empire church's initiation rites different? Well, different, then we'll talk about that in a second. Another shared trait between this first century Christian Roman Empire community and other associations and other groups in the early church, in the early Roman Empire, sorry. It's an ideal community, or it's portrayed as an ideal community. There's a shared understanding of what an ideal community looks like. So that's why you have in Acts 2 and Acts 4 and elsewhere, you have pictures of a perfect community. Okay? And there's something happening there that is meant to portray the church a certain way. And it gets beyond arguments about, wait, is this normative? Is this just simply like prescriptive? Or is this descriptive? Is this what the church is supposed to look like? Those are pictures of what an ideal community can look like or should look like. And Roman people would agree. Actually, there's been a study on these passages in Acts by this guy named Alan Thompson. And he talks about how Luke's portrayal of the church fits into a Jewish as well as non-Jewish Roman, like Gentile Roman, ideals of what a community should look like. Okay, the virtues that are involved in a good community. And so that's what we have in Acts 2, Acts 4, like the fellowship of believers. They got together. They frequently got together. They devoted themselves to teaching. They shared things with one another. There was no disharmony among them. And, you know, and we can tell that these summary statements of the early church are like sort of pictures. You know, they're sort of propaganda, if you will. Because at least in Acts 2, Acts 4, right after that, we see problems. You know, like everyone had everything in common. Now there is a couple named Ananias, etc. Yeah, all the believers were together and had everything in common. There was no one in need. And then it's like, oh, there's some widows that were complaining. You know, so even within Acts, okay, that's surely not you know, meant to be like, oh, the church is perfect. But what those passages are meant to convey is the church is a community that's ideal. Okay? That it fits our Roman, our shared Roman understanding of what a community should and can look like. Okay, we have a divine judge, and this is also in Acts 5, Ananias and Sapphira. We have Herod, we have a sorcerer named Elymas, Simon Magus, and so on. Jesus described as the judge of the living and the dead. Jesus is described as the one given authority to judge all people, this resurrected Jesus. And this Jesus is presented as a judge that is good, that is ideal. And I think the reason why Luke is really careful to keep these judgment accounts in the book of Acts, because he's a historian. He's a narrator. I mean, it's a relatively short book, Acts. Like, if you compare it to our, like, people's history of China, I mean, you know what I mean? Acts, like, so you have this book. So why is he so careful to include not just one, but multiple stories about God's judgment or Jesus' judgment? Well, because if you are presenting Jesus as a king, as a lord, as sort of a ruler, in that time, there's no distinction between a legislative, executive, and judicial branch. If you're a ruler, and this is in the Old Testament too, if you're a king, you're expected to judge cases. You're a judicial officer. And if you judge well, you're a good king. If you judge poorly, you're a bad king. And so we have to see that Jesus is not an impotent judge, and we have to see that Jesus is not a careless judge who just ignores all the cases that are going on in the world, but Jesus is a good judge, an attentive judge. He actually does things when there's injustice, when there's problems. He actually does something about it. And so that is not just a generic, like, just out of nowhere, just out of Luke's own personality, like, oh, you know, I'll just talk about Jesus as judge. No, it's out of a culture. And he's writing to people in the Roman Empire, and this is the Jesus that he presents to us. He's a divine judge. Virtues and vices, concern for being a pious and good person. That's where we have, in Paul's letters especially, we have these vice and virtue lists, like Galatians 5, Ephesians 4-6, Colossians 3 and 4, where you have the acts of the sinful nature are obvious, and so on. Treachery, sexual immorality, dishonesty, bitterness, jealousy, fits of rage. But the acts of the Holy Spirit, the fruit of the Holy Spirit, are not those. It's love, kindness, forgiveness. And these virtues and vices, a concern for virtue and vice, that's something that the church shared with other Roman people. Other Roman associations. We care about being virtuous. We care about being pious. We care about being a good person. In fact, that's what religion is all about. And so you have these early church apologists who are saying, no, actually, the church is good. You know, that we are not a force for evil, and they actually have to convince their neighbors of that. The church is not a force for evil, but it's a force for good. We have some distinctives, so moving to the point three in this session. Christian distinctives within first century Roman culture. And let's talk about two here. One, there's no image. Okay, in their religious rites, in their spirituality, there's no like image in the same way that the Romans were used to. There's no statue. You can think of Paul in Athens. He looks around. Oh man, there's statues everywhere. I even see a statue to an unknown god, just in case you forgot somebody. Just because you're so pious. I can see that in every way. You're very spiritual. You're very pious. You're very religious. But this is what I'm proclaiming to you. And this is a huge jump, actually. There's one God who created everything and who set everyone in a particular place. And think about how countercultural that is to a people who think in terms of local deities. We think, oh, we live in Ephesus, so that's why we honor Artemis of the Ephesians. But we're saying, no, this is one, there's one God who created everybody, everything, and who set people in particular times and places so that they could reach out to him and find him, even though he is not far from any of us. So there's no image. That's really distinctive. And then one last thing we'll talk about before lunch. There's no sacrifice. That's very, 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 very unusual. And you can think of in the epistles, 1 Corinthians and Romans, when there's concerns about meat that were sold in the marketplaces, that is meat sacrificed to idols. And so the reason is that most of that, generally, meat in those marketplaces are kind of what's left over from sacrifices, right? So when they do these sacrifices to the gods, they involve meat, right? Or they're killing animals and there's meat, and then they take that meat and they sell it in the marketplace. And so that's a big question for first century Roman Christians. Can I eat that meat? Because that was sacrificed to Artemis, or that was part of the sacrifice to Artemis, so should I eat that? Okay, so that's the historical context. That's where it gets very particular. And that's the thing, even the Bible, which we say is universal, which is universal, but it's very particular. So when Paul talks about meat sacrificed to idols, I mean, for us to read that and somehow make that coherent for us, that involves translation. Mm-hmm. That's a very particular context. And so we're trying to translate that for us, for ourselves. The Bible's just so crazy particular. And a lot of times we think of this sort of like ethereal, abstract document, as long as it's this beautiful, you know. But then when we read it, it's like very earthy. Mm-hmm. It's completely occasional, completely particular. Like there's specific, very specific concerns. There's specific names. Like, oh, you know, it's not just everyone love each other. There's some of that. But then there's like, and also, at the end of like the letter to the Philippians, Paul says, oh, those two women, Euodia and Syntyche, I know they're not getting along. Tell them to reconcile. And I don't know, I sometimes laugh at that because I think this is being read publicly.
Yeah.
How awkward is that? But anyway, you know, Paul says to Timothy, oh, you know, when I left you on Crete to do this. Hey, when you come, make sure you bring that jacket I left. remember that green jacket, my favorite, my favorite hoodie. Can you make
it read aloud then or now?
Yeah, right, seriously. So the Bible itself is very particular. So we're always translating this Bible. It's a particular Bible, particular gospel, particular like worship service, particular creed, all these things. And what we're doing is translating it. So let's continue talking about this after lunch, talking about how the church in the first century Roman Empire was distinctive in their broader culture. All right.